once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And let's see, today is, at least where we are, July 22nd, 2017. And just thought we'd let you know that. And this is the Personal Wealth Coach, obviously. And the Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this riveting radio program. And if you've ever been riveted, you understand what we mean by that. It is also the name of an investment advisory firm, which is headquartered in Salado, Texas, and manages, it's a wealth management firm for people with higher net worth. And it's registered with the SEC. And it's not a coincidence that the two have the same name, because they have the same two bald guys who are in charge.
Right.
And anything we say on here is not to be construed to be investment advice, but is intended to be educational. And we believe what we're saying is accurate, and we get it from what we think are good sources, but there's no guarantees or warranties made. And if you receive this email in error, please be sure to return it and destroy it.
Yes.
Or destroy it and return it, as the case may be.
I hope we were saying that back in 2008, in case we do a 2008 rerun. That was pretty amazing listening to the
Obama is going to destroy the Texas economy by sending OSHA in and the EPA in. And the thing is, I didn't realize that ex-presidents could do that.
That's from the rerun from the prior program.
And I thought that was a pretty good – that's pretty impressive, though.
Yes.
You know? And, yeah. and we're trying to determine whether or not we're going to vote for Rick Perry for governor?
Right.
Okay.
Well, he's energy secretary at this moment, as of July 22nd, 2017. This would be a fun program to replay in about 6 years, make it 9 years if we're going to go back as far as
yeah,
this one. So
yeah.
Replay this program talking about that program that took place 9 years ago in 9 years.
So we could do an 18-year time warp.
Right. It'd be like a radio time capsule.
Wow. I mean, somebody out in space 8 light years away from here could have been listening to that just now for the first time.
Right, and they realized that Obama's about to destroy the Texas economy.
Yeah, and obviously he did, and this recession is pretty bad.
What it really – this is helpful, and we're going to go into some other stuff, but what it really says is that no matter when we are, the political rhetoric is panic. Whomever is in charge is about to do something horrible. So political rhetoric and media rhetoric is, how do we get your attention and keep it? Well, we don't get your attention by singing lullabies.
We don't?
No, we get your attention by screaming, look out, about everything. So Chicken Little politics, Chicken Little media, keep it in mind even today, especially today, because, you know, it's always today, unless it's
tomorrow.
Tonight. Well, it's not tomorrow.
Well, whatever.
Never tomorrow. Never comes.
Well, we had a week in the market, and the market wasn't too weak, so that worked out pretty well. Anything else you need to know?
A week, not weak in
anyway,
the market. Right.
The S&P 500 stock index rose roughly 0.5% last week, and the NASDAQ gained 1.2%, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average slid down 0.3%, which is a pretty typical week over the last 6 months or so, as the S&P 500 is very slowly getting higher and higher. Now, it dropped a little bit on Friday. Thursday, it hit its 27th record high of the year, which is pretty cool if you
think
about it.
Is that a record to have that many record highs?
No, it's not a record number of record highs.
It's a record for this year's number of record highs this year.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the thing is, when it may break records for the number of record highs this year, because
it's just inching forward.
There's no sudden jump upwards. It's just kind of inching forward a little bit at a time.
Record-breaking growth of 0.1.
And the NASDAQ, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, and the S&P 500 take turns hitting record highs. So they don't all hit them on the same day, you see. They just – because they want to spread it around and all of that. And there's a reason that we're seeing the stock market up the way it is. There's several reasons for it. but not the least of which is that the fact that earnings keep coming in better than expected. About 74% of earnings so far this year. We've had about 100 companies of the S&P 500 report second quarter earnings so far. And the second quarter, of course, ended in the end of June. And 74% of them have reported earnings higher than expected. And 72% of them are reporting revenue higher than expected. And you say, okay, well, what's the difference? Well,
earnings, revenue, sounds like numbers to me.
Typically, about half the companies report revenues higher than normal. Higher than, and I say higher than normal, higher well, than was expected.
Let's say what revenue is versus earnings.
Okay,
first,
revenue is the gross amount of selling dollar-wise that a company did. In other words,
gross means before the expenses, yeah, before expenses. The taxes, before any of that stuff.
And earnings are profits. And what we've seen at several times in the past is the revenues didn't rise very much, if at all. But earnings went up, and because companies were laying people off and they were cutting expenses, and so they got their earnings up, but they got them up in a way that we didn't think was very sustainable. What's going on now is both revenue and earnings are rising very consistently in the S&P 500 companies. For better or worse, a lot of those earnings and a lot of that revenue is coming from somewhere other than the United States, which is why, and we've talked about this before, the GDP is relatively anemic, around 2, maybe 2.5%. But earnings growth this quarter is running at an annualized rate of about 10%. In other words, the profitability and the revenues of S&P 500 companies year over year are up about 10% from where they were last year. And you think about that for a little bit. Well, if the S&P 500, at least used to be, was the engine that drove the U.S. economy, how can the S&P 500 be up 10% and the U.S. economy only grow 2-2.5%? Well, there's several reasons for that. But the biggest one is a lot of those earnings, a lot of that revenue is coming from outside the United States.
And there's another piece to this. This is a little fun little correlation that you can look back through history. The GDP, the growth rate in the United States, has typically been about three or four times or three or four divided by the growth in the stock market or the earnings in the market.
Yeah, about a quarter.
Yeah.
About a third to a quarter third of the stock market.
So if you say three times 1.5, well, you're not talking very much. Or four times 1.5, again, you're not. There's some of the growth that we're seeing in the market is from that. Some of the growth that we're seeing in the earnings of the market. And if you look at the remainder, that's coming from other locations. It's concentrated overseas. It's coming in because there is a bit of a boom happening in the pre-industrial, becoming industrial world. They're ramping up production because we're buying more things.
There's a peculiarity going on here that kind of hurts my brain when I think about it, but it's still going on, so it needs to be talked about, I think. And that is that the fact that the dollar has fallen about 12% against the euro so far this year.
Right.
It's helping tremendously.
We talk about this stuff a lot, and I'm trying to do this program. I'm trying to go in and define some of the terms that we're doing.
Okay. You can say the euro has risen 13.6%.
Right.
Or
something to notice in that time period. People don't understand foreign exchange rates very well, because something to notice during that time period is prices haven't changed 14% here. So the change in value of the dollar against the euro is completely esoteric to us, unless we're going to Europe. Unless we're buying something from Europe, importing or exporting to Europe, that relationship is not important, but you hear about it a lot. It's important to the overall economy. But people think of it as a game of we want a stronger dollar or a weaker dollar. It isn't. It's basically what the entire world's market in money is saying the future value of a given country is, whether or not they can pay their debts. And that's the thing I think you were about to come to.
Well, I was going to talk about the profitability first. The big effect of there's a cause for the dollar falling, and then there's an effect of the dollar falling. We'll talk about the effect. The effect is that U.S. goods become less expensive, and so we can sell more of them overseas, which means that our exports go up and our imports go down because they become more expensive.
Right.
The dollar falls, so it makes companies more. If a company in the United States was earning, let's say, 10% on something they were selling, they had a profit margin of 10% on something they were selling in Europe, and the dollar were to drop, since we report in the United States
14%.
If the dollar drops that much, it goes to about $11.40. Yeah. So
11.4%.
Yeah. So what happens is, well, actually it goes up about 10%. Which means that it goes to, you're about $11.40. So in that same $10 profit,
is now $11.40. Yeah,
because the euro has risen against the dollar,
or the dollar's gotten down to the euro.
Yeah, which it doesn't
make
any
sense. It's like a seesaw.
It's all relative. You know, it's all like mothers-in-law and things like that. It's relative.
Relatives everywhere.
The reason the dollar has fallen is pretty interesting. Basically, there's some degree of, hey, the Europeans may actually have higher interest rates at some point in the future. That's built into there. The U.S. interest rates are not rising as fast as people thought. That's got a little effect. The biggest effect right now in the very short end of the interest curve can be seen. By the way, I looked at it. You can see it very, very clearly. If you go out on T-bills, which are issued for 90 days.
Treasury bills, right.
Once they're issued, they have a fixed maturity date.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the maturity date out around October, the interest rates suddenly jump. And the reason is there's an increasing risk that the treasury bills that mature in October won't get paid.
And that has to do with the debt ceilings, not even up for debate at the moment, but we're already doing extraordinary measures. Those put some air quotes over extraordinary measures in the government.
It's extraordinary.
Extraordinary. So those extraordinary or extraordinary measures are being used by the Treasury Department to pay the bills while debt ceiling raise has happened. We've got to borrow money to pay the things that we've obligated ourselves to do, and that's a problem.
The government hit its debt ceiling limit
in March,
and what they've been doing since is, for example, not transferring money into the Social Security Trust Fund, not transferring money into the Highway Trust Fund, all those little trust funds out there that aren't due for a long time. The end result is not due. They are deferring payments there so they can continue to make payroll and pay the electric bills and things like that.
Let me be as very clear and concise as I possibly can. The VA, the Veterans Administration, right now is having the debate about whether or not in the next 2 weeks to start cutting into the pay of defense. This is military retirees in nursing homes that are being covered by Medicaid. So think about that for a second, so that they can cover some other areas of healthcare for the military. They are looking at this, and it's within the law. The law, a lot of times, like Social Security, says this is what happens if you can't fund it at the normal rate. It drops this much. Well, the law for the Veterans Administration covering health is if they don't have funding, they've got to turn and cut into the retirement pay of retired military people who are living in nursing homes who are getting Medicaid supplements. What that means, by the way, just to say this as clearly as possible, when you're receiving Medicaid in a nursing home, it means you are extremely low income. If they're talking about cutting 25% of that to help pay for other healthcare expenses because Medicaid's paying for them, this is why the rest of the world is looking at the dollar and going, okay, we're not valuing it the same way. They're wrapped up around healthcare, taxes. They're trying to get things done when there's a simple measure that needs to be done. Believe me, I think we should be spending less. We're over expending, but we shouldn't spend less after we've obligated to spend it. after we've already said here, you should expect to receive this money for services rendered. Oh, no, we've changed our mind. We don't want to spend so much. That's, you already did the thing. So the debt ceiling needs to be raised, and then they need to really buckle down and work on the budget and tax reform so that we can get spending more under control, so that we're not constantly in the race to raise the debt ceiling or not meet our obligations. I consider one of the highest obligations in the world to pay the retirees from the military.
Well, the reality is that this is starting to have an impact in the markets. We've actually seen this week the 10-year Treasury note rise in its interest rate slightly, not because of the standard reasons that it goes up or down, but probably because of the fact that the threat of a default of the United States government is rising. The reason that the stated reason that I've read for the concern is by the people, at least the Wall Street Journal, who go around and talk to the congresspersons and count votes, is that there is no discussion of this scheduled before the August recess. And when they come back in September, we are going to be within a very few weeks of the Treasury running completely out of anything to do, and they shut the government down to stop paying the military like they did in 2011. And here's the problem with that. There are some major obstacles in the House of Representatives. The anticipated thing right now, according to the analysts who have talked to the congressman about that, is the Senate would pass a clean raise the debt ceiling bill, but the House would pass one saying, nope, you got to cut, you need to kill Obamacare, or you need to cut spending, or, and this is one that's floating around, balanced budget amendment from the conservatives. So the conservatives right now are already warning that they are willing to shut the government down if they don't get their way.
And the Democrats are pretty much saying the same thing on the other end of the spectrum.
Well, there's some discussion that the only way that Paul Ryan can get a bill keeping the government from shutting down through the House of Representatives is to work with the Democrats and get Democratic votes, which would probably poison the well for him, for all the conservatives, right? Because that's what they did. John Boehner got nothing else done after he agreed with Nancy Pelosi to get her votes to keep the government running. And from that moment forward, John Boehner got nothing done in the House because the conservatives just voted against everything.
Now, this is important because we've just moved from the economy and how politics are affecting the economy into pure politics. So we're going to step back away and go right back to the economy. Yeah. The politics, as we've said in the newsletter, it's the single largest piece component of the economy.
The government is
the government,
right?
Which is politics. And the fact is that the government is not in danger of being unable to borrow money or unable to pay their debts, except for some brinksmanship. If this were in a boardroom of a company, we would say this is a completely dysfunctional boardroom. They are not working for the betterment of their company. This is what we say about Congress right now. Here's the things that could be good out of this.
And there's some noises being made about traitors.
Now, finish that. Here's the things that could be good out of this. And that is a weakened dollar is good for American businesses. It means that we can sell to the rest of the world for a lot less money, and that's a boost to us. There's a downside in that pensions aren't going to get paid the way they should, but we should have a profitability increase. As we were just saying, if there's a 14% change in what the dollar is worth on the negative side over against the euro, it means that if we are capable of selling to Europe, we get a 14% increase, a boost to whatever profit that we're doing. And that's the question about whether or not we pay our debts. Eventually, we're going to do it. The question about whether or not we pay the military. Yes, of course, we're going to do it eventually. Whether or not we pay whatever the obligations are. It's the fact that we're so dysfunctional that we can't do it on a timeline set by ourselves.
And there's also the fact that if the United States of America stops paying its bills for a month, let's say.
Yeah.
That will be the first time in the history of the nation, other than one temporary blip that occurred in 2011, that the United States of America has ever not paid its bills. And the full faith and credit that was established by the founding fathers, by Madison, has made it the bedrock, the dollar, the bedrock of the world economy. And the United States Treasuries, it could be... It's a pretty devastating thing. I think,
you know, it was kind of a common practice in France for Elroy. You fill in the blank for Elroy, and I know I'm pronouncing that incorrectly. I just prefer
Elroy,
the king. Yes, all of the Louis, throw in your numbers at the end of them. They quite consistently did not meet their obligations to pay.
That was a long time.
Was a long time ago. That's the point. We've got a dysfunction that has some points in history that Elroy. We can refer back to, and we may just want to say Representative Elroy to all of the Congress people.
And there's a lot of major implications if we get there. But here's the bottom line to it, at least from my perspective. Congress passes bills year in and year out. They haven't passed any recently, but they passed last year. The House of Representatives, which is basically the same people that are there now, very few of them got replaced, passed a series of bills saying spend a bunch of money. And they ordered the Treasury to spend a bunch of money, but they didn't raise taxes to cover the amount of money that was that the law says that the Treasury must spend. And obviously, if the Congress tells the Treasury you will spend more money than you're going to take in taxes, and we know that, by definition, the Treasury has to borrow the difference.
And Congress told the Treasury that's your responsibility. We say this is what we need to pay, and you figure out how to do it. And if you need to borrow money, do it. And tell the debt ceiling and then remind us, and we'll just say, okay, keep doing it.
And the issue is if we come up on the debt ceiling and Congress doesn't raise the debt ceiling, it's saying, hey, we spent the money, we owe the money, but we're just not going to pay the bill, and that'll make us better off.
Right. And my perfect analogy is if you're at a restaurant and you order a very nice meal, and the waiter brings you the meal and you eat the meal, and then the waiter brings you the check and you say, oh, no, I enjoyed the meal very much, and I should be back here tomorrow to have another meal, but I've decided I need less credit card debt, so I'm not going to pay for this.
Now, our telephone number in here is 254-773-1400, and if today is July 22nd where you are, if you've got another view on this, because I know there are people who support shutting the government down if necessary, certainly give us a call and let's talk about it.
There's a couple of other pieces that I'm going to throw in there. So 773-1400, this was a great segue. One of the big things that happened this week is Elon Musk, who's the CEO of Tesla and chairman of Tesla and who owns SpaceX privately, the company that's resupplying the International Space Station and is putting up satellites all over the place and is returning back to Earth with rockets so that it can be reused. One of the things that came out of it was Elon Musk spoke to a whole bunch of governors, as in state governors this week, all at one big group. And one of the things that came up after his talk was mildly mentioned during his talk, was that in 2011, there was a contract that was up for debate at NASA. NASA didn't have the money to hire people to do it in-house, kind of as a internal contractor, where NASA got to keep all the rights. They were talking about, what is the number? $4 billion in cost plus contract to do the resupply to the ISS internally. Versus the $443 million they paid to SpaceX to do it and allow them to do it as a private company. So the ratio there from 4 billion to 443 million is almost a factor of 10, where the government spent one tenth the expected amount and is getting much better service out of it. Now, the difference in those kinds of contracts is that the company that did it, SpaceX, is allowed to profit from the technology that's created to meet the contract versus the governmental side that says no. So SpaceX is putting up other people's satellites besides just NASA. They're doing more than just supplying the International Space Station. Having said that, that is a big area where some money can get saved. Not enough money, but money. And we're talking about over a 5-year period. It may save the government $100 billion. That's a lot of money. Don't get me wrong, I don't have $100 billion, but when we're looking at the problem in the budget for the United States, it's nickel and dime. The big ones are defense, Medicare, and Social Security, and the upcoming soon the paid prescription drug benefit plan, because that is completely unfunded. I think you're aware of that. So each of those pieces are things that can be done to improve the budget of the United States, but there's some hard debates that have to come. Right now, it's not likely to happen because it's my way or the highway from both sides.
Yeah, and one of the, so what's this got to do with you? Well, obviously, there's a couple of things. One, there's a threat that the government will get into shutdown mode
Right.
and get completely locked up, in which case I can assure you with a high probability of certainty that we will see a stock market drop. Don't worry about it, because the key to dr that's driving the stock market right now is corporate earnings. And yes, a chunk of those corporate earnings come from the government. They're the biggest customer. I mean, Boeing and Lockheed and places like that, which are part of the S&P 500, obviously get a lot of their money from government contracts, and they are not going to fare too well if the government stops paying them.
Yeah,
But
and the S&P, remember back in 2011, downgraded the standing
Right.
of government debt for the United States, because if this is the kind of debate that's going to happen regularly, people aren't sure if you're going to pay them back.
Yeah, and it's so A, just hang in there if the stock market takes a dip, because everybody will suddenly wake up and realize, oh my God, we got to pay the bills. The other thing that you can be aware of, and that is you, whoever you are, your congressperson, your member of Congress, be aware of which way your member of Congress votes on whether or not to shut the government down. It's and then make your decision based on whether you think that's a right or wrong. I've just kind of casually asked people about which way John Carter voted on that issue back in 2011, and I couldn't find anybody who knew the answer, which indicates we're not paying a lot of attention.
Right.
So just be aware of and realize that there's going to be obfuscation where you to try to hide unpopular votes.
What we tend to see, though, is people that support or are of the party of their congressperson tend to not pay attention how they vote. The people on the other side pay attention to the incumbent from the other party.
Right.
And
So
so, I mean, it's one of those things where if you voted for John Carter, our the local representative, it's unlikely that you're checking his voting record, but his opponents sure are.
just it's a, it's just a good idea if you if you see this coming up and you and it happens. Right now, members of Congress are generally not held accountable for such votes. And if it affects you one way or the other, then hold your congressman accountable, or thank your congressman for being brave and saying and a responsible vote, whichever way you feel on it. But the issue is be aware, because that's what makes or breaks a member of Congress. And we can't change the whole Congress, but we can, you know, we can affect what happens with our given congressman. And let's see what else is going on in the big wide
We
world.
should probably get to some commercials here.
If we got great commercials.
We've got some.
All right.
We'll be back on the other end with more of the personal wealth coach If you'd like to join us in the meantime, the phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back on the other side of these commercials. We'll be back.
You use Tearless Baby Shampoo.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone number in here, 254-773-1400, and I see something suspicious.
Oh, I see something suspicious. We just heard the PSA for the Homeland Security Department.
That you should report anything suspicious. Yes.
There's a bald man in the studio. Two of them.
There's a flashing light in the studio that says that there's somebody who's given us a call on 773-1400. Well, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, when you talk about deficit spending, you know, the problem is it's the same thing that Jefferson and Madison said, you know, that central banks are more dangerous than standing armies. And the problem is when you have a Federal Reserve system that the government can go to borrow money when they overspend their budgets.
But the government does not, the government does not borrow from the Federal Reserve.
No, it's the other way around most often.
Well, either way, the government...
They borrow from the from the taxpayers and the bondholders.
Whoever buys a treasury bond is loaning to the government, and the vast majority of treasury bonds are owned by U.S. institutions and individuals.
In fact, the Federal Reserve is selling bonds right now.
So it's the other way around.
The real issue is that when you don't have a balanced budget. And whatever those debt instruments are generated, the government has an obligation to repay those debt instruments with interest.
Yeah, you're right about that.
I mean, when you're $20 trillion in debt and you're pushing those pieces of paper into circulation, that's the true definition of inflation.
Yeah, except we're not having any inflation.
Right. The
reality is that you've created incentives to deindustrialize the nation. With NAFTA and other trade agreements, and then when you have a depopulation, because that's one of the four elements of any economy.
Hang on just a second. NAFTA has reindustrialized the nation, not deindustrialized.
Yeah, we're at an industrial capacity that's the record-breaking, the most amount of industrial capacity we ever had.
Well, from the data that I've looked at, and the source eludes me at this point. The number of manufacturing jobs in the United States is not increasing.
That's different.
That's different. Industrial output and number of jobs are very different things. Our industrial output is higher than it's ever been, but we're doing it with the same number of jobs that we did in the early 1800s. Yeah. So the jobs are being lost there, but they're not being replaced by foreigners. They're being replaced by robots.
It's like saying that our agricultural production has fallen because we're now using 1%.
Yeah. Well, the thing of it is, if you look at the industrial base, and I mean, it's clearly documented that our industrial base has decreased. The number of jobs that have been lost through overseas
Wait a minute. Our industrial base has increased. It hasn't decreased.
Let's look at Texas, okay?
Okay.
In Southeast Texas, the major oil corporations, Motiva, BASF, Borealis, mm-hmm. Total. Who owns those companies?
The shareholders?
No. They're owned by foreign nationals.
No.
BASF is an Austrian company.
Okay, if you go on the New York Stock Exchange.
We're going to try to have a conversation rather than talking on top of each other. So we need to take turns.
You know, you're stating that these companies are foreign companies. Well, so is Toyota, but Toyota makes most of its cars in the United States and has lots of employees in the United States.
And on top of that, when he answered with shareholders, shareholders, the majority of Toyota shareholders are in the United States.
Well, no, as far as obfuscation and framing the debate, you need to let me share some information. You know, I'm the guy that's listening to your show and patronizing your advertisers. That's the name of the game here. What you have is when you industrialize and you move the ownership and the revenue that can be generated from taxes to foreign entities, you're not helping the economy.
Hang on,
and then when you have a central banking system.
Hang on, just a second.
Wait, caller, you're one point at a time.
You made a point.
Make a point. let us rebut it, and then you have a point, and then we.
If you listen, if you listen just a second to what I said just a few minutes ago.
Me and let me argue my case.
We just heard you make a statement. We're going to say, okay, you have said a point. You've made a point. Your point is very clear. You think that the industrial output and jobs of the United States is less. We answered that, and you changed the subject to who owns companies.
The shareholders own companies. The majority of shareholders of Toyota are in the United States. Toyota
is a foreign company, and we admit that. You admit that. You've got some points that you're making that are almost correct, and we're hitting the points that you're hearing us argue with you, and we're not arguing.
The real issue. The fact is, the government doesn't have enough money to pay its bills. That's
correct.
That's
absolutely correct.
Now, what is the problem?
Because
the problem is, anytime you have a central banking system that the government can acquire debt from,
but it can't.
You're going to have that problem.
It can't. That's you muted an if then, but the then doesn't exist.
The Federal Reserve bought up U.S. government debt on the open market, not from the United States government.
Right,
there are no
buy
new.
Buy it up, but how do they get the cash into the hands of the government?
The Federal Reserve does not put cash in the hands of the government. The government goes to the public.
Woodrow Wilson signed the Federal Reserve Act of 1913,
yeah,
and on the absolute disaster this would cause. Even Senator Lindbergh in 1913, when that thing was signed, said we've created a disaster.
Yeah, he also said the Nazis were the wave of the future too. The same senator.
The point of it is, my dear friend, I would encourage you to read Carol Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, and maybe go educate. I need to take that damn master's degree I got in economics and go flush it down the toilet. But thanks for dominating the show and not let people talk.
You're not talking?
Nice,
you're talking right now. Okay.
Okay.
I guess he's gone.
A couple of major points there. The government does not go to the Federal Reserve and borrow money. They just,
right.
It's against the law. They can't do it.
Here, let me just kind of timeline this. The Federal Reserve, when they buy up bonds on the open market, it's to fight inflation or deflation. They're not allowed to go to the United States government and loan them money. The danger is having this Federal Reserve system that's making this huge profit and doing it. That's where the cash goes to the government. Any profits that they make in the transaction go to the government. The underlying factor that the caller had there was absolutely correct. We're spending more money than we're making on taxes. That's a problem. How do we fix it? I didn't hear any kind of solution. I heard him go back and attack the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve isn't spending lots of money, and nor is it a source of new revenue to the United States government. The profits it's making are, again, nickel and dime compared to what the tax revenue and shortfall to the tax revenue is. Deficit spending is happening. If you could do deficit spending by just getting loans from the Federal Reserve, where would they get the money from?
We agree with the caller on one point, and that is, at this time, with the economy healthy, we should have our spending and our taxation balanced out at the very least, so that what we're spending each year is being compensated for by tax income. During recessions, by definition, we go into deficit, because if we're spending the same amount of money and the income tax revenue drops because we're in a recession, well, obviously we run a deficit. Ideally, and this is the way every economist that I know of that's famous has said, during times when we are not in recession, the government should be running a slight surplus. And what that means in a nutshell is the government taxation needs to slightly exceed the spending. That way we can pay down debts during good times that we run up during bad times. It's a very – any business person will tell you that's the way to do things. The problem we're into right now is the fact that – and you have to look at the House of Representatives, because that's where these bills start. In the House of Representatives, the discussion right now with us running very large deficits and having, as the caller said, a very large debt that we owe. The discussion on tax reform is how do we cut taxes? And cutting taxes during a time when we have full employment, while we have large debts, means we're going to cut our income, but we're not going to pay down our debts, and we're not, and we're threatening to not pay the debts that we have that are due immediately, and that's the subject we're talking about.
Now, there tends to be an effort that gets pushed in a different direction when we start talking about this. It's easy to look for conspiracies here. It's easy to say that the elite set up a banking system that does fill in the blank, or the Democrats knew about this, or the Republicans knew about this, or Trump or Obama. It's really easy to say we want them to be smart enough to have a conspiracy, that somebody's doing this on purpose. Unfortunately, that's not the nature of a democratic republic. We've got a lot of people in our country, and many of them are competent. We probably got more competent people than the rest of the world, but we also have a lot of incompetency. And what's happening in Congress right now, when we're talking about a problem as to why we have deficit spending, well, you can lay it directly at Congress's feet. They're the ones that write the checks. They are the ones that ask for the money. And they can't agree on what they want and what they need. Obviously, as a government, we need to pay for certain things. What we need to pay for has changed over the years. So we're paying for a lot more that we need, whatever that means, than we used to. We're paying more than we're earning in taxes. That doesn't have anything to do with the banking system. It doesn't have anything to do with industry. It has to do with over-obligating on a budget. Mm-hmm. And it's a very simple thing. It doesn't need a conspiracy. It just needs a bunch of people that can't agree with each other.
And here's the point that I wanted to make on this. And it's and we are not concerned about the politics, except in the way that it affects us and our clients' portfolios. If we run up against a near government shutdown, it's going to damage the markets, both the bond and the stock markets. And that's where people go to have retirement income in our free enterprise society that we have. There's no reason for us to go into this shutdown other than, I don't know, I can't understand the reasoning behind it. The issue boils down to the fact is the same Congress with very few replacements, same House of Representatives, voted for a bill, a spending bill last year that we are under now that spends more money by far than the government takes in revenue, but they didn't increase the taxes to cover the revenue for the spending. And then to turn around and say, some congressman to turn around and say, we're just not going to pay the bills, is fundamentally irresponsible. If we and everybody loves a tax cut, I love a tax cut, except for the fact that if we're going to have a defense budget as big as our defense budget, if we're going to pay Social Security, if we're going to pay Medicare to older people, if we're going to have a border patrol, if we're going to have all those things that we want, there's a cost, and we know exactly.
We got to pay for it.
We got a really, really, really clear picture of what that cost was last year. And we have a really, really clear picture of what the tax revenue is based on how the taxes are set up. Now, there's minor arguments over tiny little bits of it, but the bottom line to it is the House of Representatives consciously has a situation set up, meaning collectively, any individual should either needs to recognize that this has happened, where we draw in less taxation money than we spend. Now, how do you fix that?
Either spend less or raise taxes. Those are the only options on the table. I mean, we could change the way we spend to spend less. We could recognize that there's less things that we should be spending on. Those are very difficult conversations that don't seem to be very popular right now. Or we could raise taxes. Again, not a very popular option, but those are the options on the table.
And as far as the Federal Reserve is concerned, the reason the Federal Reserve Act was passed was because of the crisis of 1907. If you don't understand the crisis of 1907, what happened in 1907 is we had a banking collapse start to sweep across the country that was going to generate another major depression. We'd had one about 10 years earlier, and J.P. Morgan stepped in personally and gathered the bankers together and got enough money to start to counter the banking crisis. And when he and his banking friends ran out of money, they went to Teddy Roosevelt, and Teddy Roosevelt, on his own personal word, borrowed the equivalent of a couple of $100 billion from the British central bank, because they did have a central bank, in gold, and had his Secretary of the Treasury, again without authorization from Congress, go to the floor of the New York Stock Exchange and write Treasury obligations on pieces of paper and sign them. They were called exchange notes.
Right.
And when we got the gold in that we'd borrowed from England, we covered the exchange notes and we stopped a banking collapse across the United States. And in a banking collapse under those circumstances, anyone who had money in the bank, in any bank, if they'd all collapsed, would have lost a very significant portion of their savings, and it would have caused another major depression.
So they created the Federal Reserve.
To hold those reserves so that J.P. Morgan or somebody like him,
private citizen,
wouldn't have to go out and basically manipulate the government using gold that we borrowed from England.
So the Federal Reserve is there, and the reason why there's the government appointment that goes on to the board is to make sure that the people in charge at the Federal Reserve are not tied to the banking system too closely. So Ben Bernanke, Janet Yellen, it's very normal to have people from politics, much more normal to have people from academia be on the board there to say this is the way we should approach it. Now, it's not popular because it's not well understood. Even if it were well understood, it's not popular. It's one of those – it's the only tool we have for this whole section of things, and we've got a caller on 773-1400.
You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Oh, we lost him.
Check it out. Hey, this whole issue, it's interesting because there's a paper that was published this week that showed that we did not avoid inflation when we were on the gold standard. We had bouts of inflation that ran about 5 to 7 years, followed by bouts of deflation when we had a depression. During the 19th century and prior to having the Federal Reserve, we had a depression every 10 years. And during the depression, we had deflation. Lots and lots of people were out of work. People lost their savings. People lost their farms, their houses. And then we would go back on the gold standard. We would have deflation because, very frankly, there is not enough gold to cover the monetary needs of the United States. There's literally not enough gold in the world. And then we would get into a severe depression, and Congress would take us off the gold standard with no controls other than Congress as to how much money exists. The money supply would balloon up. We would have double-digit inflation. Congress would put us back on the gold standard. We go back into deflation. This happened every decade during most of the 19th century, and I saw the data on that. It's pretty obvious. With the advent of the Federal Reserve, we've had amazingly stable, the Federal Reserve Act has been amended so many times, but particularly following the Depression, when the Federal Reserve was given the control of the money supply, we have not had a depression since. And we used to have one every 10 years. We had one in the 1920s. We've had a recession.
Yeah, and the difference between recession and depression is big. People don't seem to realize that because the recession was bad. Recessions are a movement back in a shrinking of our output. It's to recede, like a wave recedes. A depression means that things really basically just stop. The depression, one of the major characteristics of it is deflation. And we had a little bit of deflation in the Great Recession. We didn't get the kind of deflation that was normal throughout the 1900s. That was considered still normal when we hit the Great Depression.
1800s.
I'm sorry, the 1800s. You're correct. The 19th century. Sorry about that. It was very normal back then to have great big bouts of time when the dollar in your pocket could buy more than it bought 4 weeks before and 4 weeks before that, versus what we have come to expect is there's a slight increase in value of products over time. That causes businesses to expand. Being
News Radio 1400 KTEM, serving Central Texas, KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.